Maybe I'll try and get this one out by like 2 days after Halloween, which is our next Friday.
Also, we didn't have a lot of parts that really need to be edited out.
Yeah, we just have the parts you said about racism and how you don't really think it's real.
Yeah, exactly.
No, those are the only parts that I need to cut out.
Welcome, listeners and viewers, to another episode of Unresolved Textual Tension. Today, we will be discussing Coraline by Neil Gaiman. And it is almost Halloween.
And here's my co-host, William.
The ruggedly handsome, as Katie always forgets to say. By the way, this is a Patreon live stream, and this is Coraline was picked by our patrons, but it was in time for Halloween, so that's pretty cool. And I've been wanting to read it for a while because I've never actually read any Neil Gaiman, and I thought it would be kind of cool just to see what, like, to because he's such a known name to really dip into it.
You've never read Neil Gaiman?
No, I read a short story from of his that I remember being like, oh, that was creepy. But no, I've never actually read any of his stuff.
Dude, you wouldn't like most of his stuff. Based off of your like whimsical thing, but you would like some of his stuff though. What short story did you read?
It was about like three guys who went out and then they met a girl and the girl was clearly a siren and she like kind of scarred the guy's mind forever afterwards. I remember being like, oh, he actually wrote that really well. But okay, so that's my background. And what's your background with Gaiman and also Coraline?
Well, with Coraline specifically, it was on the required reading list for 4th to 5th grade. And so I read it while I was in Alabama with my cousins and for my required reading. And I had to write a little book report on it. And I remember reading it and thinking, this is really, really scary and cool. And I remember having a nightmare about the button eyes while I was in Alabama. And I just, like, I remembered the things that really kept in my brain were the rat scenes and then the hallway scene when she's going between the two places. Neil Gaiman, I think that was the first book I ever read of Neil Gaiman's. And then going forward, Neil Gaiman and Holly Black, like, write vaguely similar. Neil Gaiman's, like, more like an old British dude, which makes sense. And Holly Black is more like a crunchy hippie from, you know, Seattle. So that makes sense. But Neil Gaiman, I think for, like, most of my life was the author I aspired to be. And I used to follow him on all his social media. And then I used to like read all his stuff and like think I was like coacher and shit. And then I realized, oh, wait, no, he has a lot more stuff. And I was like, oh, wait, I actually don't always love his writing style. And then I grew beyond that. But then one other thing, though, is what was it? It was... Oh my God, how did I lose my train of thought that quickly?
Well, I will say that I felt like his writing style worked perfectly for this story, but see is that if he doesn't vary it up a lot, it might not work for all of them. Sometimes writers find a story that just meshes perfectly with who they are as a writer, and like no other story they write quite meshes with it as well, really. And in this case, he has like a very simple, clean, but striking way of writing that's really cool, that fits the kind of starkness of this story really well. And it really makes you like listen to the silences between what he's describing. And I think that's one of the reasons that people... I'll just stand up right up front. I really liked this story. I found it very pleasant to read, but I didn't find it scary and I didn't even really find it creepy. But then I'm also a 45-year-old man.
For a child, it's quite scary. I mean, even me now, because I can relive back then, I that same little bubble of... I wouldn't say scary. It's just uneasy and gross. It's gross in some places, and I'll get to that in a sec. But as a small recommendation, actually one of my favorite short stories of his is called October in the Chair. And it's part of Fragile Things, his collection of short stories. And it's like 6 pages long, but it's really cool. And I think it's one of his more powerful, like, he does really good with like heavy metaphor and like almost like folklore-y sort of, because he mimics that those kind of writing styles anyway. But yeah, I read the foreword on this book, which wasn't created until 2011 based off the date that comes with it. And so I didn't read this foreword when I was younger, and neither did Juan, my husband, who read the book right after the movie came out in 2009 or something like that. So it still wasn't written. And he wrote that he wrote this for his first daughter when she was young. But then they moved to America and he got caught up in like working and taking on jobs and stuff like that. And so he never finished it. In fact, he never got past like the first page. And then when his younger daughter, Madeline, was around that same age, he was like, shit, if I don't write this book now, I'll never write that children's book I wanted to write for my first daughter and have a young daughter enjoy it. So he finished
it. Hilarious that he thought this was a child's book. Like, he was like, oh, this is, I can't write this at any other age. This is only for children.
To be fair, Coraline does feel like this is a wonderful example of writing a child right.
That's true. Yeah. The complaints I have are basically that it doesn't also work for an older audience. Like, it's very much just for children.
Yeah.
In terms of like the content of it, not necessarily the writing of it.
Laura says, got to get that trauma in early.
Very funny and very true. But yeah, apparently the movie, which I haven't watched, I watched a few clips yesterday, but like, it's so gaudy and garish compared to the writing style of the book. I immediately disliked it.
You know what's funny is that I understand what you're saying with that, but actually, funnily enough, it's exactly the only difference. Okay, so I get what you mean by garish. It's because apparently that's the word of the weekend too. but it's because the colors are very saturated, whereas in the book, everything seems very gray and monotone and like almost sepia in its vibe. But funnily enough, everything that happens in the movie has the same essence that it does in the book.
I don't like that they basically just have a male OC insert in the movie, like just for no reason. There's a dude who just does that seemed kind of weird. I would have liked to see an expanded role for the cat. By the way, my favorite part of this book is that the cat ain't shit when it can't run away. Like, I love that as a turn for the cat, because the cat's being all superior and then it's like, oh shit, I can't run away.
Really, really love the cat's voice actor in the movie. It's because I felt like it's not the way it's supposed to be. Like, well, I kind of feel like it is though, because it's described in the book as like the voice of the cat is like her voice but male. Or something like that. It's like this, it's like hearing her own thoughts in her own voice. Yeah, Keith David. Yeah, I really, really, really liked his voice. I felt like it was perfect for the cat in the movie. And the movie is, so the book is creepy, like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark creepy. And then the movie is creepy, like The Thing creepy.
That's interesting. And again, I didn't watch the whole thing. And also, probably at a different age, I would have found it scarier. I found claymation and
I hate claymation puppet
stuff like so creepy as a kid. The uncanny valleyness of it is horrific. Like, you know, there's a whole subreddit, I think, for terrifying children's media or something like that. So I really liked this book. I don't think that this will be a super long recording or review, just because there isn't necessarily a lot to talk about under the surface, and it is a short kind of story. None of our patrons really had any final thoughts on it. Only like two of them did, which I think kind of speaks to it, and that it's like, it's very well done for what it is. Just what it is not.
Oh, okay. I really like what Laura said. Laura says, yeah, because, okay, so YB is the insert male character in the movie. And she said, yeah, YB made it much easier to have that exposition. I think for a movie, it also helps to have another child for her to bounce off of. It makes it more action-y, bombastic, whereas the lonely terror of the book. That is 100. That's actually a really great thing to say, is the lonely terror of the book, because the biggest part of the book that makes me sad and depressed is how lonely she is.
That's very true, I think, and that she's very much going up against these things alone, except for the cat, who's not super reliable. I still think the cat should have had YB's role. I was about to say that, and then we could have had Monster Boyfriend.
I really, really love the cat. The cat's actually my favorite character in the entire book, as well as the movie, besides Coraline herself, because I actually quite like Coraline as a child protagonist. She's got faults, but she's also got a lot of cool strengths to her. Like, for example, the entire sequence in the book, which also vaguely happens in the movie, when she's trying to take care of herself, because she's like, what else am I going to do now? And she tries to take care of herself, and then she's like, shit, I missed my parents.
Yeah, she's like, oh, I gotta go find them. Did you have any overall thoughts about the book? And like, maybe also just like the impact you had on it now versus when you originally read it.
One of the things that struck me really hard in this book is the fact that I got to page 80 in like 5 seconds. You know, it reads so quick. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because it's not like his other books. His adult books, which makes sense. It's because his adult books use a lot of eloquent language, and it's like steeped in metaphor and analogies and like all that stuff. So that makes sense. But there's a lot of no fluff. There is no fluff. There is no cartilage in between the bones of this story. And as I was reading it, and it went very quickly, and it jumped from one thing to the next, and very also yet distinct and very what's the word I'm looking for, textured, I guess. Yes. You know, like there were a lot of detail without also there being a lot of detail, and this just really hit me as like, wow, this is actually a really interesting version of his writing. It's because usually he's just almost purple prosy, whereas this is just very to the like stark in comparison. And I'm assuming he did it for the age range for one reason, and maybe also he was just in a different part of his life for another. And I guess another thing was that it was a really good example of how a piece doesn't have to have a lot of detail and show you a lot of things and explore all the aspects of what it's giving you for it to be a good story.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It tells you what you said earlier. It is such a picked to the bone, like clean story in terms of how it's told and what happens in it. That's one of the reasons it's hard to criticize it, because it is only the good parts. Like all the other extraneous parts have been expunged. And again, most of my problems with the story are just things it could have done, but even then I'm not sure what it could have done. I could just tell that it kind of should be done. But yeah, it's interesting that he writes in more purpley ways, because yeah, I kind of assumed this was just how he normally writes, because again, I haven't read his other writing. But maybe then, yeah, that he was specifically writing for a child's audience, because like I noticed there was like a little bit of a lack of similes and stuff like that.
The more mature devices are missing.
That makes sense then, if he's maybe writing it more for children, which again, I don't know why you would write this for children. Like, that's that weird adult thing where they write really horrible things for children.
Kids love that. I mean, I loved, what's the book
to
I
be
just
fair,
mentioned?
Kids, if they come up with stories, come up with horrific stories that are weird. I had a cousin who used to put the Barbies in the oven and go, "We're burning, we're burning." And his mother was a therapist, which was hilarious. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and, what's the premise? Who is Coraline and not Carol? Caroline. I'm actually very
I was just
tempted
gonna say
to put
that.
Sweet Caroline as the intro song to this video.
Coraline is about a young girl who is incredibly bored and whose parents work full-time at-home jobs in a new flat, and I'm assuming someplace in the UK because they call it a flat. And also what houses in the US have
they
like
have
an
tea
old
all the time as
yeah
well.
And also what okay, there's not a single place in the US where there is an old Victorian house that has multiple people living in it as flats. But so anyway, Coraline and her family has just moved in. They have neighbors below them that are two women that are vaguely lesbian-y, but are not for sure, in my opinion. I think they're just Maria and I if we never found husbands. And they were both old actresses, or they were very famous actresses in their day, but now they just have a whole bunch of Scotty dogs, and their old ones are stuffed, and they just kind of like bobble around down there, and they're all fat and, you know, old. And then upstairs is a crazy skinny dude, old man, who trains rats, and the rats whisper to him things. And
he's vaguely ethnic of some type.
Yeah. Yeah,
I listened to the audiobook, which Gaiman himself narrates, and I was like, oh, is that a French accent or is that an Indian accent? And I just couldn't
really
figure it out.
It's because I think in the movie itself, I think it's like vaguely like Northern European sounding.
Oh, interesting. I think later it mentions he's like from Albania or something like that.
That would make sense to me. Yeah.
Oh, really quickly, though, because Thea, correct, said middle grade horror is definitely a thing, Will, and I read somewhere that kids don't take it the same way as adults. For them, it just reflects how they see the world. Mm. Also, we all agree they were definitely a lesbian couple.
I think it's just, it's how you take it. I think it's how you take it. It's because there are some moments where I'm like, oh, that's very coupley of them. And then there's other moments where like, oh, that's codependent. And like, they never made it anywhere or had a family.
Also, I'm just going to say it. It's a little essentialist to assume that two women together have to have some kind of a romantic or sexual relationship. It's a little homophobic. Just saying. No, but in terms of the middle grade horror stuff, I don't know, because I do think this is an interesting question. So one of the things is when we read Remnants, that's middle grade and that is horrific. But at the same time, I really liked it as a kid. But I'm also a little bit different in that, like, I don't know how much I've talked about it on this podcast, but like, I have a lot of depression and anxiety issues, and intrusive thoughts and recurring thoughts and all of that kind of stuff. And so like, things for me, if they're disturbing, will hang out in my head for like a good 10 to 15 years.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Honestly, a lot of stuff. It's funny, actually, because me and my mom will sometimes talk about like movies we watched or something as kids. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that horrified me. I hated that. That scared me. Jurassic Park, I find a terrifying movie before the dinosaurs, because everything's sort of slightly mean and claustrophobic, and I just don't like it. So I'm sometimes not sure how much of like, I don't like that is a me thing, and how much of that's like a... The thing is, I don't think I can be comfortably scared. I think I have trouble being comfortably scared until I got on medication and then I started loving horror movies, funnily enough. But I do think, yeah, I think for normal kids, it's like, oh, they do like learn a certain amount of horror if it's contextualized correctly.
I really enjoyed horror when I was younger because of very obvious, like, I mean, I know you know, like, why I might enjoy horror. It's because it was cathartic to see some it's so, I mean, there's so many reasons why, but I can, like, a lot of my friends who are going through things, you know, at that age, that, like, you know, were more, they were being abused or sexually assaulted or something like that, and even those who weren't, and they just led, like, you know, their own issues in their own heads and stuff like that. It's very cathartic to see it represented, those concepts and ideas represented in themes and books. Like, looking back on it, obviously I didn't get any of that at the time. I was a literary analyzer from a young age. But it's weirdly comforting. That's why somebody told me, what was it? Oh, I was talking to somebody. I was like, yeah, I find Dune and Blade Runner 2099 or whatever to be comforting. And they're like, those are not, I don't understand what you mean by comforting. But that's what I mean, though. It's like, it's weirdly comforting to be in the presence of something with that atmosphere when that's like home to you, but you're safe while you're in that home.
Someone just described about it was that it's sort of like, discombobulates Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So if you're stressed about something and then you watch a horror movie, all of a sudden the survival of the character rises to the top of the pyramid. So you actually find it relieving in a way to not have to deal with the stress, because it's short-circuiting it, essentially, which I think is makes sense. I don't know. I'm also just drawn to really disturbing things, but I don't find... I'm fascinated and drawn to them, but I don't actually find them cathartic. It's kind of a weird thing. But again, I think that might be a me thing. I don't think that's necessarily how other people do it.
That makes sense. I mean, I went through, I mean, I'm sure you heard Maria complain about it for a really long time because we watched so many movies together. But like, there was a really large chunk of my life where all I ever watched was horror after horror after horror, because it was like, I don't know, weirdly comforting.
I like horror now because, again, I'm on medication, so I don't get anxious about it. But okay, so we didn't even really start. What else is the premise of Coraline?
Coraline and her family, mother and father, full-time workers, vaguely depressed and over. Okay, so her mom, let me do this. Her mom is painted as a woman who's very forgetful, who's trying her best, but definitely isn't like natural mom material. And like, for example, when she cooks, she makes like frozen pizzas and fish fingers. And she forgot to go grocery shopping at one point and needed to go grocery shopping. And she's waited to the last minute to get Coraline her school uniforms. And every time that Coraline asks to do something or engage with her, her mom is like, no, not right now. Go do something else. Go bother the ladies downstairs. Go outside and explore in the rain. And at the same time, though, when Coraline asks her mom certain things, her mom engages with it and shows her and entertains her in those smaller moments. So it, Neil Gaiman did a really good job, like, showing she's not a great mother, but she's not a bad mother. She's a loving mother, but not a great mother. And the same thing with her father, where, because her father's constantly working, and every time Coraline comes in, he's like, not right now, I have stuff to do, go do this, go do that. And they're like inane, thoughtless things. But at the same time, later on, Coraline recounts how her father one time stayed behind to get stung by wasps, so she didn't, and he wasn't scared to do that. It's because he loves her so much.
So one of the things that's interesting is, because the book is written in such a simple, sparse way, there's a lot of blank spaces left for the audience to kind of fill in what they are thinking, and also, and different interpretations. And so the way I took it is that this is a child's view, almost, of how boring life is, even, like, it's weighted towards Coraline's viewpoint, in that to her, the world does seem kind of boring, and your parents do kind of seem unreactive at times, because they're not paying attention to you the whole time, and they don't necessarily know what to do with you. And I don't know, my view on this has changed a little bit ever since I had nephews, and I realized the existential horror of trying to keep a child entertained. You don't understand. It's like you're shaving 15 seconds off of the day, like one at a time. You're like, they're looking at a pebble. That's it. I've got 30 seconds. I'm 30 seconds closer to the end of the day. Like, well, kids are so insanely boring to take care of.
Oh, there's this one kid, his the family friend. His mom worked from home, and I went and babysat while she worked from home. And that's like the worst, because the parents there, and it's like, wow. Like, and she gave me too much money an hour because she was a family friend. So then I felt indebted, and like I had to constantly entertain him, and I couldn't just exist. So I literally at one point like just sat my butt on the floor and was like, okay, run into me and I'll catch you. Because like that was the least amount of effort than running around the house.
Well, okay, so the thing about it is that the way we parent in the West is, or, I don't know, specifically here, is really dysfunctional, in that you're supposed to parent in groups, essentially. And so the pressure is never on the one parent to entertain a child, because that's such a bizarre way of, like, you're having a full adult's job be to entertain a child. I always remember my little sister went and volunteered in the Amazon at one point, or she did a science trip there or something. And she was, yeah. And she actually lived in like the Amazon next to a village. Like, she had like a tiny boardwalk about this big. She had to go for about a mile to get from her place to the village. And they basically just let their kids roam all day. And all they did was like hunt lizards. And that's always what I think of when I think of my nephews, is that like, really, they should just be hunting lizards all day. Like, not literally like hunting for food, but just like for fun. The way my dog hunts for lizards, like, they kind of catch them sometimes, they kind of don't. But it's like, you need enrichment for children, but children really just need to be in a group and find an activity to do, and that will enrich them. You only need to artificially enrich them if they're unnaturally isolated in the way that they are nowadays. And so, again, going back, Miss Alex Snow said, I think when you read this as a younger person, the parents come across as not caring, and in rereading it as an older person, you sympathize with the parents.
Yeah,
that's very much, I think, the way. And so the narrative is skewed a little bit towards Coraline's view of it that way. I kind of thought that was going to be a bigger theme in the book. We'll talk about how the book doesn't really have themes per se. Like, it's not like she's really tempted by how much more interesting the other world that she finds is. They say, like, hey, we'll do more stuff with you, but that never felt like a real thing she was interested. Like, I never got, like, oh, the whimsical coolness of the other world, or that there was any real temptation to stay there.
The movie does that better.
Yeah, no, then that makes sense. But, like, that just to me is something I felt like was missing a little bit. Well, it's hard to say anything in this feels missing, but I think that's an opportunity that Gaiman could have gone into.
There's only like a watered down theme a little bit. It's more just literally telling the tale of Coraline. And there's not really like I think the only lesson she learns is that she has to be patient. Like, that's literally it. Because if you notice in the, also, God, I gotta say, one of my favorite, I know this is like nothing, but my favorite part in the entire book is, it's again, it's nothing, but it's when the cat is speaking with her when they're walking out in the place that's not nowhere, but also not somewhere, you know? Mm-hmm. And the cat's like, challenge her, those kind of things, her kind of things like that. And I love that nothing is said that she's a fairy. Nothing is said that she's fae or that she's a monster or that she's the Beldam, even though she is a Beldam at that moment. It's just really nebulously stated, and it's so horrific in that way. And I really just love the way that's introduced.
Yeah, no, I really like that it was not, she was never defined. And I always just find that much creepier in that she's just some kind of thing that you've heard myths about or some myths about something similar to her. So Coraline, she's bored. And then she finds a door that used to open to an apartment, but now it's been bricked up. But sometimes when she opens it, it leads into a dark corridor. And so she goes down it because she's bored. And on the other side, she finds another mother and another father, or other mother and other father. And they're like, hey, do you want to do some stuff? And Coraline, she's real chill about this in that very kind of flat child way. And she just like hangs out in that world for a little bit, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah. Also, as a side note, Miss Ali Snow brought a really good point up. It's the same as The Wizard of Oz. There's no place like home is the theme of this, which I get that. I can see that. That's a perfect idea of what basically what it is that he's writing. But yeah, no, you're right. So basically after her boredom and everything and exploring around the place and everything, Coraline, you know, sees this strange round door and asks her mother, and this is just a little bit more detailed to what Will was saying. She asks her mother, what is this? Like, and she's interested because she's an explorer. And so her mother opens it up with this really old, thick iron key and is like, it must have gone to the other flat that's for sale on the other side. But now it's all bricked up. And as Will said, when she goes to explore it later on, well, actually, to be fair, the first time after that is in the middle of the night, she gets up and there's a black shape that she's like, ooh, what the heck is that? She follows it and the door is slightly cracked open. And so she closes it and she's like, her mom, mm-hmm. As soon as her mom was like, she was like, aren't you going to lock it back again? And her mom's like, no, why would I? There's nothing on the other side. I'm like, you asked for it, Mama Bear. Mm-hmm. You asked for it by doing that. But anyway, so yeah, Coraline goes over there and then they're just like, I think the biggest thing, which is kind of sad, the biggest thing Coraline likes about the other world is the food.
Yeah, I noticed that. That was funny because she doesn't like that her dad is bad at cooking and cooks all these weird things all the time, which is so funny.
Like all she wanted was a simple roast chicken.
Yeah, she hates spices and things, which is like so particular to her. One thing we haven't mentioned is that Gaiman is just really good at getting into the mindset of a child and how a child thinks. And there's just a lot of little touches. I tried to remember some and can't remember any. It really feels like how a child thinks about the world.
In this other world too, each of the characters that we already just introduced have like their alternative selves. So the other father is waifish and just like adherent to the other mother, honestly. He doesn't really have all that much of a presence. And then the two ladies downstairs, I really like how the movie portrayed this because it's literally exactly how it's described in the book, which is cool to discover. How they like unzip their old fat skins and walk out thin and beautiful. And they're like just performing constantly and their audience is all their Scotty dogs and it's like ridiculous. And then the man upstairs is a circus. What's the guy that's in the middle called?
Bobo?
No, the ringleader. He's the ringleader. Oh. And there's, you know, his circus of mice. And to answer whoever it was that asked before, I forgot. I do not think the mice are real, or if they are, they're just normal mice scurrying around and he's a little schizophrenic.
Yeah, exactly. I think he's touched a little bit and so he's closer to that world.
That's how I took it as well, which is why the mice warn.
A couple of people have said that the theme, after I said it wasn't, Thea says the theme was stated, no one wants everything their way all the time. That's boring.
Yeah, which is true. It's because when she eats the ice cream for dinner and when she does all that, but her parents aren't around at all. And she does get everything she wants. And also in the movie that actually compounds that, because when she does go to the other world, it's really beautiful and magical and crazy. And so, but when you do that, like it's too much. It's not like there's no structure and therefore it doesn't feel special anymore.
Yeah. And then also Laura said, also don't trust people that will give you whatever you want. There's always a price. So the thing is, when I said there wasn't really a theme, I meant that the theme isn't, or these lessons or messages aren't really integrated into the story again. So it sounds like in the movie they were like, okay, the other world is a real temptation, whereas in the story, like,
I think it's just softer in the in
it's
the
a
novel.
Creepy liminal place from the very beginning. There's no temptation for her to stay there, and so,
except for the food,
that kind of thing, except for the food. Yeah,
this entire novel has like this kind of like mothball smell feeling, you know.
Yeah, that's funny.
Overall, I just think the themes are softer in the novel. I don't, and again, I think it's really because I don't think Gaiman was just writing this for his daughters, and I don't think he was like,
yeah, the things about it I wanted are more like adult things in the cloak of a child's story. And so, like, again, it feels a little unfair to complain about it or to say that he should have done more, because, you know, not everything needs to be a Pixar movie that works on two levels. She also at one point talks to the cat, which is the same cat she saw at her old place, but is now a different cat through the magic of cats. And the cat can talk, and the cat's fun. It talks like a cat. Cats are always just good characters to have.
I love cats, I swear to God.
You know, the thing about it is that real cats, and I didn't realize this till like you and Maria, real cats are so much more needy than the propaganda about them is. Like, actual cats are so needy. They're more abusive than aloof, you know what I mean? They're more like, pet me and now I hate you, I spurn you.
Yeah, I know. I'm, hi Max. Yeah, no, I, in Baldur's Gate, I keep trying to pet all the cats and they're like, don't touch me. And like, there was this one part where I was like, one of the dialogue's options is, may I pet you? And I said that and they're like, and it like goes back up on its like thing and it's like, you may not. And then it just ends the conversation. And I was just like, yeah, that's Hank. That's my fucking cat. So I guess I can't complain.
What happens next? Because she basically just goes to the world and then, oh yeah. And then she comes back to the normal world and her parents are missing. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, she's actually very chill about this. She kind of makes herself dinner. She goes to sleep. She gets herself more food the next day.
And she calls the police.
Well, the thing is, there's a moment where she goes to sleep and then she wakes up and she's like, I want my parents. Which is like just a very kind of child way of handling it. Like, that just sudden moment of like, oh, I want them. And so she calls the police very sensibly. And the police do not believe her, which she is annoyed by. But what are you going to do?
I think it's really cute, though. It's because the policeman's really sweet.
Yeah, she's nice
like,
about it.
He's like, oh, honey, like, you know, just why don't you go tell your mom this and ask her and tell her to make you a big cup of hot cocoa and tell her the policeman told her to. And then Coraline's like, I don't think that'll work. And then he's like, oh, you know what? I think it'll work for sure. And then she's like, okay. And then just hangs up.
That's another way you know this is in Britain, is because if it was an American policeman, somebody would have gotten shot.
I was just saying, if it was American policeman, they would have showed up and then they would have shot Coraline and the cat.
So, and then at that point, she's like, okay, I gotta go. I don't know how she knows. Oh, no, she has a dream, I think, that there's, that they're in.
She's talking to the cat and the cat's, nodding its head instead of verbally answering because he can't. And she was like, do you know what happened to my parents? And so he brings her to the mirror that's in the hallway. And she sees them reflected in the mirror. And they're like uncomfortable and they look strange. And her mom writes in the mirror after breathing on it, help us. And Coraline's like, okay. And I actually, another part of the book, I really, really liked how like elegant it was done, was how the transition of Coraline walking back through the tunnel to go to the other world and the cat just starts talking to her. Because during this time, she's been talking to the cat and the cat's been listening, but there's not been any dialogue back or forth, obviously. But once they start going, then he just starts talking and it's like, oh, there's the transition for the magic. And it's just like, it's really nice. It's just really elegant and soft and really beautifully done.
Oh, one thing, I listened to the audiobook version of this, which is a guy narrated by Neil Gaiman. But the thing about it is there's a weird like soft rock number between some of the chapters. That's like
what?
Weird music. Like I think maybe in the book it's supposed to be like a mono, like, you know, like a little bit of writing about she went looking for her mother or something. It's a weird thing. And then when the mice sing, it's a different actor singing in this really trembly voice that's like creepy and took me out of the story. So I feel like UK audiobooks from a certain decade did this a lot with the music. Yeah, and that's true actually, because at the end of the book they're like, if you would like this on audio cassette or CD, and I was like, oh my god, how old are you? How long ago was this done? So she goes back to the other world and other mother and other father are waiting for her and they're like, oh, here, you can stay here.
You just need to pluck out your eyes and sew in buttons instead. I think it's really interesting that he chose buttons for eyes though. Like, why? Like, is that a folklore
teddy bears
thing?
Think about it. Teddy bears used to have like,
no, I know, but why
like
that
stuffed animals?
Because there aren't teddy bears involved in anything.
Well, because it's a child thing.
I know, but I just feel like that's, I'm curious of the inspiration behind that.
Well, and you know, the eyes, the soul, and all of that.
Oh, I get that's true. That's true.
She ends up sleeping there, and when she's sleeping, she has a dream. No, that's not when it happens. She like goes out and does something that the Bell Dam, the other mother, doesn't like, and so the other mother throws her in a closet.
Oh, she talks back to her. She talks back to her.
Oh,
that's
is that
all
what
it
was?
Is. Yeah, they're sitting on the couch, and there's this okay, but I get it scene. And actually, no way, I take it back. I love this scene specifically in the book, not the movie, because in the movie it's just like a sack. But I like, there's a weird urban vibe. The Bell Dam, or other mother in the book. So they're sitting on the couch, and Coraline has actively said, I'm not going to do what you want me to do. I want my parents now. You're not fooling me. And so they're sitting on the couch and having like this stalemate. And the other mother leans over the side of the couch like a freaking alcoholic cigarette, Marlboro Lights smoking mother, and grabs a convenience store bag and brings it up under her lap, and inside are a whole bunch of little roaches or beetles or something.
Oh yeah.
And she's plucking off the legs and then eating it like little candies, and it's like the plucking off the leg is like the unwrapping of the candy and then eating
which
them.
Which is funny because they just do that in lots of places of the world.
Yes, so. But I just thought it was interesting that
you're reading this in the Philippines. You're like, wait, is this supposed to be creepy? That sounds like a good snack.
I'm so dumb. I thought it was really interesting. It really caught my attention because he specifically described the plastic bag, and I was like, why is he doing that? And I thought, is it because like this place is like a where things like it's like a gutter.
Lost things end up.
Yeah, it's like a gutter. You know what I mean? So does mm-hmm. she like live in a gutter? And like, you know, it's very the other mother's very spider-y in theme. It's because at one point the cat says, when Coraline's like, this place isn't very big, and he's like, it's big enough for her. And he was like, it only needs to be as big as a spider needs to catch flies or something. Like a spider's web's only as big as it needs to catch the flies. And mm-hmm. so anyway, I just really liked the plastic bag thing. It's because everything else in this world is like, you know, it's like unique and like magic-y, but that's like real day, common day, normal store thing that she has. And it just makes the Bell Dam seem like grosser. Of course she's eating bugs, but like that's even like a weirdly compounded thing.
And so she's like, hey, you eat one. And Coraline's lion is like, because Coraline's defining feature is that she's picky, is like, no, I'm not gonna do that. And so then the mother throws her in a basement that's like kind of dark, or a closet, and in there Coraline hears the voices of other children that the Bell Dam mm-hmm. One of them calls her a Bell Dam. That's why I keep referring to her that way.
It's the only time you're given any information as to what the other mother is.
And so, and that's because one of them is like from Victorian times. These are kids that she has trapped the souls of, and when they died, they couldn't go on. They were trapped here in this place, and they're not happy about it. And so Coraline is like, oh, okay, I'll save all of you guys. And they're like, that would be great if you could do that for us.
That is when Coraline challenges her.
Yeah, she basically, I think the cat earlier had said like, hey, you got to be careful, she's going to cheat, but she does like games. And so Coraline is like, hey, why don't we play a game? And the mother's like, ooh.
A game, you say.
So it's like a searching and finding game. And she's going to find the kids' souls and then also her parents. And then this part of the book I felt like was a little lame, because usually in
it
like
is.
Fairy tales, like either a lot of times it's a Chekhov's gun, like they saved a
yeah.
bear and then later the bear comes and helps them and you're like, okay, that was convenient. But like, or like they have to kind of outsmart people through a certain way. And she doesn't really have to do that. There's not like a lot of thinking involved.
Yeah, she has the stone to be able to identify what's like what's true or not. That's fine, I guess. This is like I would agree. This is like the weakest part. It's because I would have preferred, I don't know, just like some more engagement, I guess. I don't know.
Well, the thing about it is that the things she does are a little scary, but Coraline is not an emotionally created enough character for like you to really feel quite how scared she is at times, or for that to be a relevant challenge of how scared she is. So like something like her having to outsmart them somehow, and that speaking to the themes of the story would have been really nice. And instead, it's just like there's really creepy creatures. There's one that's an amalgamated of the two ladies, and then there was the other father who has now become like kind of decrepit because he told her something, and so the other mother was not happy about it. And there are like rats, which the cat eats one of the rats, which is very funny. And the thing is, this whole time the cat has been very like, you know, cat-like and haughty, and then at a certain point he realizes that the mother has closed off all the doors to the world, and now he can't get out, and he immediately turns into such like a little bitch. He's like, I don't like this, I'm scared, snarling. And Caroline's like, okay, because again, this whole time he's been a little patronizing to her, and I like that all of a sudden there is that role reversal where he just turns into a cat, and it's like, okay, I am the human in this relationship.
Is there's this one part where the cat is talking to it's when he's playing, the reason I say this is because you mentioned him playing with his food. There's this one part where he's like, I don't like rats at the best of times, and it's not that I like rats at the best of times, the cat said conversationally as if nothing had happened, but the rats in this place are all spies for her. She uses them as her eyes and hands. And with that, the cat let the rat go. It ran several feet. Then the cat with one bound was upon it, batting it hard with one sharp clawed paw, while with the other paw it held the rat down. I love this bit, the cat said happily. Want to see me do it again? I love that. No, said Coraline. Why do you do it? You're torturing it. The cat said and let the rat go. And then it's literally immediately below that is the quote that I wanted to quote, which is the part where it's like, he's saying, oh, you're being kind.
Yeah, he pulls the whole liberal no moral consumption under capitalism, where she's like, why do you do that? That's so cruel. And he's like, I at least may sometimes let the rat go, whereas you guys always kill the thing.
Yeah, how often does your dinner escape?
Liberal, checkmate.
I really, really like that. I think that's great.
Yeah, that was funny. That was good.
There is one other quote while I'm at it, and it's just that. It's at the beginning of chapter 6, and it says, and I really liked this because I feel this really hardcore as a child, and I feel like a lot of kids do. So let's see here. Sometimes Coraline would forget who she was while she was daydreaming, that she was exploring the Arctic or the Amazon rainforest or darkest Africa, and it was not until someone tapped her on the shoulder or said her name that Coraline would come back from a million miles away with a start, and all in a fraction of a second have to remember who she was and what her name was and what, and that she was even there at all. And I really liked that. It's because it's like, yeah, like that's like every person that's has an imagination that got lost in it.
She eventually finds each of the little kid's souls is in like a marble. And she has like a stone she picked up earlier in the book that helps her figure this out. And then she figures out that the mother, one thing we haven't mentioned is that the other mother, the Beldam, she created the house and then some stuff outside the house, but like not a lot of stuff, and like it's very kind of like fuzzy, and that's because she can't create new things, she can only copy things, she can only mimic things. And you know, I like that. That's actually almost a very like Christian view that only God can create and the devil can subvert. And like, I don't think he's hearkening back to that, but I did like it as the idea of the Beldam as like a parasite. Lindbergh in the chat has mentioned that like the place that she inhabits is not even actually hers. Like it's older than hers. She's just a thing living in it, almost like a spider living in a hole, I felt like.
Yeah, that's, I think that's on purpose. But that's also because, and as a comment, Neil Gaiman talked about this story, I don't know, in something I watched. And he explained the Beldam, it's a folklore creature that eats children in Irish mythology. Mm. And so it's just, he's just using that as like the structure of it.
I like less now that I know it's a real thing. I like better that it was just.
That's why he doesn't talk about it though, because he uses the inspiration for it, but he doesn't actually refer to it as much other than that's, it's like an Easter egg that one Victorian kids mentions it.
Okay. Yeah, no, I thought she was a nice amalgamation of a lot of creepy things without actually being one in specific. So she can't create new things, she can only use old ones. And so at one point Caroline had noticed there was a snow globe with two people inside, and she's like, that's weird, we don't have a version of that in our house. And so she realizes like, oh, that's are my parents. And so she hatches a plan, and the cat at this point really wants to get away, isn't scared, so she has it on her shoulder, she's having to carry it. And she goes to see the other mother, and she knows the other mother is going to cheat. She's not going to let her leave. So she says to the other mother, I know where my parents are. They're in the doorway. They're in the dark passage. Do you want me to, why don't you open it and we'll see? And the other mother's like, that dumb kid, I figured it out. So she opens it because she's the only one with the key. She can open the doorway. And then Caroline throws the cat at her, grabs the snow globe, and then they run away through the corridor, which I did like. See, that was kind of like very clever. And that's also where she says the theme, which is that it's you can't always have interesting things. Sometimes you need boring things, which, again, it's the theme. It's just not really played out in the anyway. And I really liked that. It was very creepy. And by this point, the other mother is not even looking like her mother. And she's like, how did I ever think it was my mother? It's just this like horrible nightmare creature with scuttling hands and stuff. I liked it. I thought it was a good description.
Yeah, no, the other mother is quite awful. And I like how she's not like a bombastic villain. She's literally like a spider where it's like, oh, I don't have to do much now that you're in my web. I can just watch you struggle. I don't have to, you know, give you long speeches or anything like that, like in a lot of children's villains arcs and stuff like that. So, oh, wait, hold on a second. Angry Otter. Because she was talking about things in the 90s.
Well, the book is somewhat dated in the 90s and said specifically the fat phobia we talked about.
Angry Otter Discord, dude.
But just a second ago, hearing Darkest Africa was kind of jarring.
I know. I had the same moment when I was quoting it. I was like, oh, That's like, that's a
weird
very,
turn of phrase.
That's very British imperialism.
I think I also missed the fat phobia. I thought that the old ladies were portrayed well. And they were the only fat people I remember.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Can you mention it a little bit or explicate on it, Angry Otter? Just because I didn't read that part of the Discord. I always get such FOMO. Everybody in the Discord is having these conversations like a month before I actually get to read the book.
In the movie, I would agree with the fat phobia thing. It's because it's portrayed very grotesquely. In the book, though, at least I don't remember. I kind of skimmed through the scenes when she's going, you know, to go find the souls and everything. So maybe there's something there. But I know that when they're at the very least in the real world, I just think they're supposed to be tottering old women is what it, and they're supposed to be like cozy grandmas, like cozy old grandmas.
Yeah, that was my impression as well. And that their idealized versions had to become thin in the other world for their marvelous performance.
Yeah, but I think that's just youth.
Yeah, I read that as youth. I didn't necessarily think it was the author saying anything, because the other world is a weird warped version that's trying to placate Coraline. Lindbergh says it was the description of the fat lady Coraline met out walking in the mist. The description of the lady focused very much on how fat, round, and waddling the lady is.
Yeah, but that's one of the two ladies, though.
To me, that didn't ring as fat phobia. I may be wrong, but to me, it just read as cozy. The real distinction lies in how no other character was focused around their weight. Yeah, it could be. I mean, it's not something that pinged for me, but it's also not, I think, I don't think it's like an invalid reading or anything. And I think it's an interesting thing to bring up.
I mean, it is there. That's the purpose of it being there, is because the women are unhappy with their, like they're nostalgizing their glory days.
Well, I mean, that leads into an interesting question of how much of the other world is a mirror that the other people want of themselves. Because you could also theoretically think that Mr. Bobo isn't reading them. He in this world has the mice, and so that's why in that world there are mice. Yeah, that's funny. I should have realized that before. I had always read it as like there are mice in this world and there are mice in that world, and that's how they kind of follow. But really, the reason that her eyes and ears and spies are mice in that world is because of Mr. Bobo having the weird schizophrenia about mice in this world.
Oh, wow. That's actually really smart.
And then basically, they get back to her world. Her parents are there. It's really nice. There's like a very simple but nice moment with her father, which comes up and says, hey, Dad. And she hugs him and he's like, hey, what's up? And then he lifts her up and takes her to bed. And it's funny because in any other book, that would be like such a normal thing. But in this book, because there are such silences and every little thing in the text matters, it just felt so warm for him to pick her up and take her to the dinner table. And then this is the part where you realize Coraline wasn't just being picky. Her father does suck at cooking because the pizza is like kind of doughy and overly crunchy at other parts, which I feel as a kid who was incredibly picky and still is, I feel vindicated. And then she goes to sleep and she has a dream with the three child souls where they like play. And then, like, they're going to have to go die after that. But they also realize that one of the Beldam's hands is on this side of the world and is going to try to get out. And it's going to, like, be up to mischief. So Coraline, and I didn't love this. And I understand that the point is that, like, even after the great moment in a story, like in real life, the story keeps going, you know, like there isn't a climactic moment and then just a little bit of falling action. The story keeps going and never really ends. And that's what Coraline keeps thinking about, is like, I got out. It's unfair that there's now more to do. And so her dealing with this hand is that. But I just didn't think it was like very, again, this is an example where it's like there's kind of a theme there, but the story hasn't been about how difficult reality is versus fairy tales. And so
he likes to break that weird mold where it's like, and then what happens after the story's done, you know, like, because again, it, so I funnily enough, oh Jesus Christ, dog, there's a right here, this is what I was looking for a while ago, and it was in a box that was still in the garage, and this is also by Neil Gaiman,
The Sleeper and the Spindle.
Yes, and Chris Riddell does the artwork, which is really, really cool.
Oh, you know the other story of his I read is one where Sleeping Beauty is, or not Sleeping Beauty, Snow White is a necrophiliac. It takes place from, it's called Glasses, Apples, and something else. And it's from the perspective of her, the evil witch or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's not that Sleeping Beauty is a necrophiliac. It's just implied that she's like some kind of undead creature and the prince is a necrophiliac.
That's similar. That's not like, so this is a very lesbian-y story. But the, so it's Sleeping Beauty and then it's also Snow White. Snow White is the knight. And Sleeping Beauty is Sleeping Beauty. But Sleeping Beauty is actually not Sleeping Beauty. She's the witch. And anyway, so she turns into, like, the real Sleeping Beauty has died long ago. And so it's really interesting. But anyway, it's cool. It's because, here, actually not died long ago. See, look, this is the moment where she realizes, like, the witch is actually not Sleeping Beauty. Or, like, the Sleeping Beauty is actually the witch. And then the old lady was actually Sleeping Beauty. And so there's this like whole moment. But the thing I wanted to mention for this in particular is that at the end, Snow White, like there was like a wedding going on, like she was gonna get married and be the queen and everything. And there was nothing wrong with that at the beginning. Like she was like, I mean, you could tell she was a little wistful for her knighting days. But at the end, it's just like they walked. So her and the dwarves, it literally is like, it's just wild, honestly. It's because they go to the east. They walk to the east, all four of them, away from the sunset and the lands they know and into the night. And it's like, where are they going? This is never mentioned. And so Neil Gaiman does that a lot where they, like, the story keeps going, but there was no setup for it.
And that's kind of what I felt like here is like, I kind of get what he's going for, but also like, it feels like the Scouring of the Shire. Like, I get what you're going for, and in the Scouring of the Shire, it makes a little bit more sense in terms of what he's saying and how it's been built up. But like, emotionally, it feels unfulfilling, kind of like in Piranesi, where like there's a lot of falling action. And basically, she traps the mother's hand in a well. She uses her like cleverness to do it, and then she puts the cover over the well, and apparently it can't get out. And then that's how the story ends.
One thing to take away is that, again, Neil Gaiman has some pretty stellar writing, but as I've gotten older, I've really seen a lot of the faults in what I don't vibe with. It's because I do, like, I appreciate breaking the mold, but sometimes when you break the mold, it like works, and sometimes it just feels like it keeps trailing on. And I like something that has a bow on top of it, if that makes sense. You know, like it's been wrapped nicely. It has a great inside. All the decorations are on, and it's a neatly wrapped bow. I like that. I enjoy experimental things, but most of the time they don't always like have that finished feeling, and I like the finished feeling.
I always feel like if you're gonna break a story rule, essentially, mm-hmm. You need a really good reason for it. And I didn't feel like this had a really good reason. This was otherwise a fairly simple tale. But and in being a simple tale, again, I really enjoyed listening to it. I really liked it. I wasn't creeped out or scared, but I really liked it. I think it would have been cool to have run into when I was younger and would have been more creeped out by it instead of how old I am now, which is 53. And so it's one of these things where I liked it. I liked it. I'm glad we picked it. All right. Thank you all for joining us. We love you, our parasocial darlings.
And Happy Halloween.